Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Reading from The Great Scientists. I've read this before, perhaps, a podcast, but hopefully I'll improve this time through. Now, the story is that I'm off the internet for a day or so while, and this means loading up stuff, researching stuff, selecting what to read, and that's due largely to having a heart monitor test, and so I've decided I'll go off the internet. And this section is rather interesting. It's got the ancient, the Middle Ages, Renaissance, 17th century, 18th century, 19th century, and 20th century. So we'll go through that list of people. And having a quick look, it's a pretty sad sort of capture of them, sort of the textbook, what they put in their chickadees textbooks as the major scientists, whereas having read, there's basically, I find it almost impossible to talk about scientists without talking about philosophers and how we basically set up the question of science. So even the idea of science is based on maths and philosophy, a combination of those two to get in it, into it, and then going through it. I don't even see Francis Bacon in there, but let's just read this. Science has been around for a long time, since at least the days of the ancient Greeks. In addition, it's clear from consulting the archaeological record that the older Babylonian Sumerian civilizations had rather more than rudimentary grasp of medicine, astronomy, applied mathematics, not to mention engineering. Even then, I do struggle there, sort of, applications of science rather than the actual methodology of science, which is sort of led to religion. Just reading next, from around the 6th century BC, however, we see signs in the ancient Greek world of what could be perhaps be called the first scientific revolution. Well, I think this is pretty stupid that they actually don't talk about the Chinese. No longer satisfied with the gods as the ultimate answer to why the world is that where it is, Greek thinkers began to search for the underlying principles which could be the basis of a more satisfactory explanation. Oh, I think that's really stretching it. But the idea that human thought is just not the sum of the most wise people in the village might be the general thing. The great tales of Midas proposed that this prime substance... began to search for the underlying principle which would form the basis for a more satisfactory explanation. The great thinker proposed the prime substance was water. Anaxagoras believed it was air. Xenophon proposed rather less glamorous option of mud. Democritus astonishingly proposed the first atomic theory. The word atom comes from the Greek atom, literally means indivisible, or you just can't cut. Gee, and it's also they have Aristotle came up with earth, fire, air, water, and ether, which is pretty amazing. It sort of gives you that general view here. Okay, just how inappropriate the word would be not recognized until the most spectacular, illustrated in the most spectacular fashion by Ernest Rutherford in the 20th century. This has to be the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That splitting the atom, he investigated the internals of the atom, but you'd have to say Thompson split the atom by removing the electron, and he didn't split the nucleus, the Germans did. Otto, that group did. What we read in the works, in the pre-Socratic philosophers, we would not perhaps recognise as science, but we can see the glimmerings of the scientific method in the rejection of truth by authority, and the search for causes and principles based on the observation of reason. Truth as the providence of thinkers rather than priests, perhaps. I think that's not so much where the truth is, it's just that there's, I think, Parmenides, who's at the time of Pythagoras, around before Pythagoras, was the idea that there could be a question that we don't know, that we are it's not just uncovering truth, there is unknowability. With the advent of Euclid and Archimedes, whose monumental works on geometry and trigonometry, among others, are still required a reading on mathematics courses today, we find ourselves in terra cognita, recognisable science. That's recognisable science as they have. I think, I don't know whether Euclid was any particular person, Archimedes was more an engineer than anything else. The progress of science from then to the present days has not always been straightforward, however. Science has frequently been in conflict with organised religion, and on these occasions scientists have often seemed to come off worse, not the least because the practitioners of religions have been prepared to resort to threats, intimidation. It sounds like Donald Trump talking about it. Even assassination in order to preserve religion's privileged position as the sole arbiter of truth. No, not quite. I think they're concerned that biosecurity, their brain of biosecurity, and they tended to kill a lot of people anyway. That was the way you sorted things out. So there was the sort out that you could that an argument existed out someone's brain. It was more like a propaganda argument. So if someone said something, you couldn't stop it back, and you could. It was back in these days where people had oaths. They kept an oath for life, and if they broke the oath, they got killed. Sort of combination, and where you could make someone say something, and once you made them say something, that was stuck. It was sort of like they've said it. So it's the verbalisation of thoughts it came across. At certain periods in history, established churches have detected the odour of heresy in the scientific accounts of the cosmos, in the origin and structure of the Earth, especially the origins of humanities. This makes me chuck, because if you really read deep into Galileo, the church was far more sophisticated than they be people. And you look at Bruno, you really look into the history, it's not that you don't come down against the church, the whole thing was completely stuffed. It's sort of like a dysfunctional family. Battered and bruised, though at many times it may have been, at the end of the 20th century, science emerged as the victor, as a key intellectual discipline for the 21st century and beyond. This sounds almost so this person could be a reliever for Star Trek. The reason for this success can be stated in two words: science works. Make me vomit. The whole laborious scientific process, the testing, revising, discarding of hypotheses, the diligent construction of theories which fit the known facts, and the modification and abandonment of these as when the new facts emerge, the scientific method, in short, produces results, and results which are testable, verifiable, falsifiable. Well, I think you can only say falsifiable. And from which predictions can be made. Yeah. I think that essentially has to be it, that a prediction can be made. Otherwise, it's a historical summary, isn't it? Astrology, chemosy, creation, brackets, science, divination, onomosy, parapsychology, telepathy, ufology, and forecasting the weather from the entrails of sacrificial animals produce no such results. It's like the Spartans had this thing of attack, sacrifice. So what people did is they used to hide the altars, and so Sparta got around that by actually bringing mobile assault altars with them. And they would bring the altars and cattle at the back. So we're going to get there and get their battle. But the important thing is that these things provide another function to connect people who would be otherwise disconnected from science, say ufology, to introduce a series of ideas beyond their scientific thinking would be one aspect. I'm very much aside. Also, these things which produce false and randomized things create an order, a perceived local order, which works for the people involved. As has been remarked elsewhere, it is no accident that those societies which have actively embraced scientific method have flourished. Make me vomit. Yeah, they have, but they have also created concentration camps. Now, while the societies which have preferred instead to rely on superstition, witchcraft, and religion have failed. Oh, I don't know. I just find modern marketing and advertising is witchcraft and superstition. The men and women whose biographies make up this volume have all made outstanding contributions to their own field of scientific endeavour. They have all shed light onto more or less baffling phenomena, and have all contributed to the ever-expanding pool of human knowledge. I don't know, this makes me vomit. Now listen to this. This book makes no claim, however, to be a comprehensive list. There are many more scientists who could have been included. By the same token, this book could run to many hundreds of pages and still be incomplete. Still less does it aim to spark discussion on the nature of greatness. Such a discussion can safely be left to others. Yeah, that's almost like a non-statement to the... It's sort of like pompous shit. What it does hope to do is give the reader an insight into some of history's most influential scientific discoverers and discoverers to encourage him or her to take... their interest further. Now, what I would say is that this is a there's sort of substandard gender neutrality where you say him or her, or her him. It's much better. You could say encourage them to take their interests further. You can just there's a non a plural non sexist thing. Whether or not it succeeds in the same, then, must be up to each individual reader to decide for themselves. Ah, oh, how profound. It's sort of like pseudo-brainness. Sorry for being a bit... Now, Euclid... it's very interesting. This is the idea of... the idea that maths is how far... Given a set of axioms, how far can I go? It might be the fundamental aspect. So there's axiomatic maths, and then on the opposite side, sort of axiomatic maths, which is sort of high-level maths, functional applied maths, and then you've got group theory or maths families. Rather interesting to look at it. Okay, building on the work of early Greek philosophers such as Thales of Miletus and Anaximander, Euclid showed that events in the world could be understood in the application of reason rather than appeal to the gods. Wow. Now, Thales, I really want to get back to try and work at what he did. Yeah, gee, of course, I've got to look at those two people. Thales, all I can remember is that he went around people hated him and then... Aristotle defended him, but I really can't remember. I have to go back and read him. It is said that Euclid's great book, The Elements, is the most widely translated, published, and studied mathematical book in the Western world. It is without doubt one of the greatest and most influential books of all time. I think almost the advent of the internet talking about a book no longer means anything. Okay, The Elements is basically about geometry, the mathematics of shape. It is as such a thorough study that remains the basic framework of geometry today, thousands of years after it's been written. Mathematicians still refer to the geometry of flat surfaces, lines, points, shapes and solids as Euclidean geometry. In The Elements, which is really interesting because the Euclidean geometry is a completely abstract geometry and doesn't exist in the universe because the universe is curved and the fundamental aspect is that on your diagram, everything has got absolute time. I just really, really interesting to see. It is interesting that Euclid geometry, absolute void, a whole series of constructs, educational constructs that we use, are not reality. And it really means that we've got this big thing of teach you rubbish, and then spend some time, and then sort of an after when everyone's sick, or you know, there's been a strike and everyone's at school. Oh, by the way, here's this. It's not really important that everything we talk to is wrong. Okay. Squares, circles, parallel lines, and so on. Children learn at school today. Yeah, this is what they learn at school today. I really do want to study Euclidean geometry again. Euclid's great book also marked the birth of a whole new way of thinking, in which the way to truth can be found by logic, deductive reasoning, evidence, and proof, not simply by leaps of intuition and faith. Whereas a leap of intuition is what inductive thinking is. It's a leap and then quality control. You can either just have what you have and do quality control on that, deductive, or leap plus quality control is inductive thinking. Okay, now mankind no longer needed to regard the workings of the world as controlled by the whim of the gods, but as the natural rules that could gradually be discovered by using Euclid's methods. This, of course, is a complete fiction in terms of Newton said, I proffer no hypothesis. I'm only explaining how God does it. So this is a bit misleading in terms of the way that they're setting this up. It's just if someone read this, they would think that Euclid was anti-religious. I'm sure he was religious. However, the achievement was not Euclid's alone. He built on centuries of intellectual efforts of Greek thinkers, dating back to the most legendary Thales of Miletus in the 7th century BC. Yet Euclid's work has encapsulated this approach of thinking in such a thorough and foolproof way, as the lasting influence was guaranteed. Benedict de Spinoza, Immanuel Kant, Abraham Lincoln are among the countless people through history who have been inspired by his way of thinking. Well, I really want to get there. I want to see what Tales is. Surely you can tell us about him. I don't think Euclid was an individual person myself. Okay. Euclid the man. Very little is known about Euclid himself. It seems likely that he lived around 300 BC in Alexandria, the great Egyptian city then newly founded by Alexander the Great on the shores of the Mediterranean. The first Greek ruler of Egypt, Ptolemy Soter, 367 to 283 BC, created the Museum and Library of Alexandria and the Lighthouse. Isn't that great? The Lighthouse, and the Lighthouse was also the idea of knowledge, the knowledge which became the most remarkable intellectual education institution in the ancient world. And Euclid was probably the leading mathematician teacher there. He may have been a student there under Plato, and Archimedes arrived there not long after Euclid died. That is interesting there. So Plato was the idea of the form, the idea of the form coming forward, which is this idea, there's this ancient idea of forms. So the concepts existed in an intellectual space, and we were experiencing the actual physical realization of imperfect forms, and we recognized a chair or something like that, because we in a spiritual world had recognized it. It was sort of Platonic forms, and then Aristotle forms, different things. So Aristotle's form looks and causes seem really great, but you really have to understand in Plato's forms, and Euclid's slots in between it. I don't think Euclid is thought of being a single person, but let's see, read it. There are a few hints about the character from anecdote. It seems Euclid was a gentle, encouraging teacher. According to one source, he was... Like, this wouldn't even mark it into a newspaper. It has been said, yeah, you'd be sued for a libel thrown out, most fair and well-disposed towards all those who are able in any measure to advance mathematics, careful in no way to give offence. And although an exact scholar, never vaunting himself. Another source tells us about what happened when a student, frustrated by the efforts of learning geometry, asked what he could get from studying it. In reply, apparently Euclid called a servant. "Give him some money," he said. "Give him the coins, since he must gain out of what he learns." Which is really interesting. You've got also the idea of giving money to get people to learn things and the futility out of that. That would be a good contrast that with Pythagoras as a famous decided he's going to teach by actually giving money to someone. And what happens is that he has this boy turn up and learn maths really studiously, and when he runs out of his coins, the boy runs away and he's left without any money, and the boys just laugh. And I really do think that's a bit of the education at the moment is along that lines. Another story is how one day King Ptolemy asked if he had to read the whole of the Elements in order to learn about geometry. Euclid replied, "There is no royal road to geometry." Which is sort of really unlikely, you know. There's so little known, it is very unlikely that any of this is true. But it is pretty much all that's known. In fact, most of this comes from the writings of Greek philosophers, Proclus, who lived nearly 800 years later. That might be sufficient time. So if we're saying, you know, what happened at the Magna Carta, or... you know, what was the sayings that the Magna Carta, it would be very unlikely. Yeah. So little is known about Euclid, that some scholars have suggested that Euclid's Elements could be the work of a team of scholars working under the guidance. And others, even that Euclid is simply the name for a group of Alexandrian mathematicians gave themselves. But whatever the truth, there is no doubting the importance of the Elements and the other less known works of Euclid's. Okay, well, it is a popular book. It's just, look, you wouldn't, yeah, I couldn't write a scientific paper like that. You could, but you'd have to do a lot more work to get through. You'd have to say, well, our starting point is, and you'd put that in just a few dot points. First dot point, it could be a team or it could be a person. It's the facts don't lead to support the do not. If you were looking for a factual origin and or a popular origin, you have to say that the popular origin is just got force, it's just got the weight and momentum of popular attribution, but there's no citation. It's so far back, there's no citation. Okay, Euclid and geometry. Euclid's great achievement was to combine geometric theorems of his day in a coherent framework, or basic theory of proofs, which is the basis of science, all science, to this day. Oh, gee, that's a bit weird. Geometry was already quite well developed in Euclid's time. What I find a bit disturbing is the wave function differential calculus. Complex numbers. That really makes me sad, because we teach Euclid at school and we basically lie to kids it's only Euclid, and therefore we sort of shut out quantum physics teaching to them. Geometry is the mathematics of shape. Isn't it the measurement of the Earth's surface? I don't know, geometry, geology, earth, measurement. Okay. It's a mathematics, and probably gained thousands of years earlier, arising from people's needs to work out the area of their land. That's why it's got the word geo. It was developed to a sophisticated level by the ancient Egyptians, who used in the building of their pyramids. They used it everywhere, didn't they? Use it for columns. They called geometry earth measurement, and the Greeks adopted the term. The word geometry is simply Greek for earth measurement. In 1858, the Scottish historian Alexander Rind found a papyrus roll, the name of the reed from the Egyptians made their paper, written by the Egyptian scribe called Ahmes around 1650 BC. The Rind papyrus and other papyrus now in Moscow, the so-called Moscow papyrus, it's either called the Moscow papyrus or it's not, showed the ancient Egyptians knew a great deal about geometry of triangles. For instance, they knew how to work out the height of things from the length of the shadow on the ground. In fact, the Egyptians probably had a pretty good working knowledge of most geometric techniques described in the Elements. What Euclid and the ancient Greeks did was to develop the practical techniques in purely theoretical system, taking what might now be called applied mathematics and creating what is called pure mathematics. Don't make me vomit. The Greeks search for general abstract truths very much for their own sake, which is probably... I don't know... I think the Greeks mixed up more maths and religion, might be a better way of saying it. But what they discovered made their work far more important than an interesting intellectual pastime. Their method was such a powerful tool that the great truths it produced could be applied to every situation. I think that's getting a little bit close to Parmenides and the things like that. What was true about triangles in one situation was true about them in another, and was completely different. It was completely different, i.e. I think it is the emergence of the triangle and not a triangle-shaped thing, the abstraction. I would say it's necessarily the Greeks. Obviously, the Chinese have developed it. For instance, Thales of Miletus stunned the ancient Greeks when he travelled there by showing how his method of similar triangles could be used to measure both the height of the mirrors and the distance of a ship at sea. And I think that Thales is interesting. I don't know why they just get him back here. And I do like... they've got Euclid's windmill proof of... Pythagoras. I'll go back and reading. I really rather like reading the windmill proof, and this is the fact that if you drop a triangle, you bisect. I'll have to read. I really like the windmill proof. This is of Pythagoras's, but I think that was an interesting aspect. I think it was a Babylonian proof. Postulates, theorems, and proof. Euclid and the Greeks gave mathematics extraordinary power by turning it into a logical system. They introduced the idea of proofs, the idea that rules could be worked out logically from certain assumptions or postulates, such as a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. Assumptions are then combined to make the basic idea a rule called a theorem. Which is then proved or disproved, which is rather interesting, because ultimately you've just got a construction, and a concrete vision, a construction of it. And this is the problem that people talk about, the complete lie of Bohr, Bohr's postulates. Complete, and so they're disproved, well then the idiots... are so stupid they can't say, oh, well, I've disproved the postulates, so we can't use it anymore. Oh, please. So, I want to park on double lines or something like that. At the heart of Euclid's elements are five postulates or axioms. In modern terms, they are, which is rather interesting, that people still read it today. They don't read Euclid, no way, but they have to hear it modern. Part of a line can be drawn between any two points. 2. Such a part of the line can be extended indefinitely in either direction. A circle can be drawn with any radius at any given point at its centre. all right angles equal. If a part of a line crosses other lines so that the inner angle on the same sides add up to less than two right angles, then the two lines cross must lines that crosses must eventually meet. Okay, this is parallel lines, Euclid geometry, which is true. Now, which is interesting, is that they teach this, and then they teach the lie that Euclidean geometry exists for science to still use it, and they don't. They don't use it in space or anything like that. The first four sound self-evident to us today, and yet they were no means self-evident to the people at the time. My mental brain is hurting. A postulate is something which is not self-evident. You can't put the word postulate and evidence together. I don't know. And it was Euclid's effort to define the most basic concepts that made his work so profoundly influential. Only with completely watertight definitions of basic concepts is it possible to establish firm proofs of otherwise vague hunches. And only with completely watertight definitions can we move confidently and logically forward through each step. Any looseness in definitions immediately invalidates the chain of logic. This is someone who actually hasn't ever done anything saying this type of thing. Parallel lines and Euclid's limitations. The fifth Euclid's postulates is less self-evidence. It's about parallel lines. If part of a line crosses other lines, so the inner angle is the same side add up to exactly right angles, then the two lines it crosses must be parallel. The fifth postulate, therefore, is called the parallel postulate, the postulate which has held the basic central truth. It's the heart of all basic geometrical constructions and countless practical applications, train lines, for instance, i.e. that your train... Oh, God. However, Euclid was not entirely happy with his parallel postulates, and it turns out that he was right to have his doubts. Well, how did they know this? They just said there are only three facts we know about him, and there's a new one. Euclid's geometries worked perfectly for flat or two- and three-dimensional surfaces and most everyday situations, but just as your surface is not actually flat, however, much as it appears to be, so space is actually curved and has many more than three dimensions, including that of time, which is absolutely true. And so you can imagine that if I teach someone and teach them with a stick, beat them up, reward them, feed them that, and then we say, and now we want you to forget this, they won't. They're just, and what's more is that there's arrogance. If the teacher teaches them with an age of arrogance, he not only teaches them the misconception, but they teach them the same arrogance which has kept the teacher going. So the teacher teaches two things, the incorrect idea and an arrogant attitude. The student absorbs two things, the incorrect idea and an arrogant attitude, and goodbye, you may as well just push that student out into space on their parallel line forever. Okay. Euclid's parallel postulates means that only one line can be drawn parallel to another through a given point. But if space is curved multidimensional, many other parallel lines can be drawn, which is actually true. So, but right down to matter. Similarly, according to Euclid's geometry, the internal angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees, yet an angle triangle drawn on a ball add up to more than 180 degrees. Such mathematics called as Carl Gauss began to realise the limitation of Euclid's geometry in the 19th century. It developed a new geometry for curved and multidimensional space. However, Euclid's work has been the bedrock of geometry for 2,200 years and remains central to everyday geometry today, which is the When you say every day, you add the word I'm an arrogant asshole. Moreover, Euclid's method of establishing basic truth is watertight reasoning, that is, by logic, deductive reasoning, evidence and proof. It's powerful, now as it ever was, so powerful, will you take it as basic common sense. Well, that is that people, it's sort of like Clayton's truth. It's not actually true because you can prove it's true. It's true because, you know, some asshole can bash you up. I just find it so frustrating, people who think they know truth because they're powerful, they've got a car, and they know the policemen who come around to your door and bash you up. But you can't know something's true if you can't understand it. It's the fundamental aspect. You can surmise it's true. You can it can be enough to be as good as true, but you can't think something is true unless you can't understand it. It's a fundamental thing. I wish a philosopher had said that early on. Archimedes. Although Archimedes was amongst the world's most prolific inventors, he preferred to be remembered for his theories. His tomb is inscribed with a sphere and a cylinder, the discovery of the ratio of which was one of his proudest moments. Is there a picture of Archimedes' tomb, or is that just a report? I don't know. He's 287 to 212 BC. Give me a place to stand and I will move the earth, Archimedes is said to have declared to King Herod II of Syracuse in Sicily around 260 BC. If he was 260 BC and he was born, well, it says he was born in 287, so that's 27 years. Again, I don't know whether that's true. Archimedes had just single-handedly launched the Syracusia, a 4,064-ton. How on earth in ancient time would you get the accuracy? One of the biggest and most luxurious ships built in ancient times. Launching this beach monster had defeated all efforts of a huge timber man pulling ropes, yet Archimedes, with ingenious arrangement of levers and pulleys, performed the task by himself with ease. No wonder when that he was a legend in his own lifetime, that tales of his genius spread far and wide. He was, without doubt, the greatest inventor of the ancient times. Not only did he invent pulleys, levers, and to launch great giant ships, he built the first water pump, which is called the Archimedes screw, and still used by many places today. What we have found now is from the machinery that there were Greek machines and levers and gears on devices, which we've pulled up from the Mediterranean bed, which indicate it's like saying US know-how. US has invented everything. He created a powerful planetarium to show the motions of the planets and invented a machine to fire burning pitch at the enemy ships. And his home, Syracuse, was besieged by the Roman fleet. He constructed catapults to bombard the ships with boulders, mirrors to focus sunlight to set them on fire, grappling devices to throw down scaling ladders, and even a hook and crane to lift a huge enemy boat right out of the water and tip them over. Yeah, it's just like these devices were developed in Greek theatre, and we'll see if they mention the Greek theatre, and so he just applied them across. Yet in some ways, Archimedes' inventions are the least of his achievements. Indeed, he did not hold himself in much esteem. Like most Greek thinkers, he placed higher value on abstract scientific mathematical ideas than on their practical applications. The Roman writer Putriac insisted that Archimedes... And look, when you see Pliny the Elder, when you really read these Roman things and you've at least got schoolboy Latin and Google Translate, you just shake your head. And what these books don't really get across, let's read what Patriarch said. Archimedes did not design to leave behind him any written work on practical inventions. He regarded this as sordid, ignoble, the construction of instruments, and in general, every art directed to use and profit. He strove after those things in which, in their beauty and excellence, remain beyond all contact with the common needs of life. Sort of like, I don't know, Patriarch would be like quoting from TV Week, sort of, or from a school's textbook. All we know of Archimedes suggests that Patriarch was seriously overstating the case. All right. Because Archimedes, more than any other thinker of his time, did not hesitate to build machines to try out his ideas and to construct practical experiments, he was generally excited by his own inventiveness. All the same, it is his pure intellectual achievements that were lasting legacy and made him the greatest scientist in history until the time of Isaac Newton, who was in awe of him. So, and that is true. This is the ability to talk about lines, talk about triangles, talk about buoyancy and convert it from one object to another. In fact, Archimedes was the world's greatest scientist. Other great minds before him had studied scientific subjects, and there are many less famous Greek thinkers whose achievements in science deserve to be remembered. But he was the first person to think about problems in a scientific way we now take for granted. I think he did, but there was no science outside his own head that demonstrated that. But I think there's the idea that as a scientist you were valuable to a king, and the king was valuable to society, and that's how science got to the society, through a power structure, rather than, as we think now, of science just for itself, and that science is of interest to all people in society. That's my view. I don't know. Think about his abstract theories. Could all be proved or disproved by practical experiments and mathematical calculations, which is a method that has led to nearly every achievement in science today. I think what really came across is that he was a model builder. I think, but so like model building was, you know, but I think it came out of theatre. Like theatre was a model of culture, and therefore you could add that model of culture. You could add models of maths to it. So it sort of evolved that way. Okay, so I'm just going to check on the time, because I don't want to be... Okay. Archimedes' life. Archimedes is born in 287 BC in Syracuse, Sicily, which is a Greek colony, i.e. The Greeks was... Basically, it's the California of the Greek world. And the reason that the Greek colonies were there is that the Greeks were displaced by the Persians coming across. He was Greek, not Sicilian. Italy was frontier time, sandwiched between warring powers of Rome and Carthage. And yet it was by no means an intellectual backwater. King Herod II, the son of King Gaon, was enlightened, intellectually inclined ruler. Indeed, Archimedes may have been Gaon's tutor. You've got Rome and Carthage. It's pretty amazing that Greek was, you know, Rome was, the Persians displaced the Greeks, and Rome and Carthage began to fight. It's pretty amazing how Carthage reminds me a little bit, Well, they're just, both of them are such Nazis, aren't they? Like, Romans are really like Nazis. All the same, if anyone wanted a proper education, Alexandria in Egypt was the place to go. And here, Archimedes went as a young man. At this time, he was there, the city was the greatest centre of learning in the world, although the museum or university were only barely 20 years old. The city itself had been founded by Alexander the Great just half a century earlier. It already held an unrivaled library consisting of at least 100,000 scrolls. Yeah, right, so a scroll, right, it's like two sheets of paper. So it's like a, a library, it would be like the Encyclopedia Britannica or slightly smaller, including all of Aristotle's priceless personal collection. It was there that the great Euclid taught geometry, and Aristotle showed the earth revolved around the sun. Epicurus made the first great catalogue of constellations, categorising the stars in terms of brightness. It's pretty amazing, that one. It was there, much later, that Ptolemy wrote the Almagest, the most influential book about the nature of the universe for 1,500 years. Euclid was probably dead by the time Archimedes was there, but Archimedes undoubtedly met Eratosthenes, a brilliant thinker who measured the circumference of the world to within 4% of modern figures and made a measurement of the Earth's year precise until barely half a century ago. Although Archimedes got his grounding in science, the mathematician thought, oh, that's interesting. Eratosthenes. So Plato and has written his plays. So it's screenplays. And so that's going through. Although Archimedes got his grounding in science, mathematicians and mathematics in Alexandria, his activities was by no means purely intellectual. Whoa, he was a bit of a lad. Sound reports that he was employed for a time as an engineer on a large-scale irrigation works in the Nile Delta. And it was probably while he was in Egypt that he invented the famous screw or plumb for plumbing water. But once, it's sort of like Aristotle, Galileo invented the telescope, like bullshit. Or the microscope is interesting though. But once he returned to Syracuse, he stayed there all his long life, inventing, studying, thinking. Accounts of his life in Syracuse paint him as an archetypal, absent-minded scientist, so absorbed in high thoughts that he neglected his everyday needs. Which nowadays gets diagnosed as dementia or autism. The most famous story about him concerns the discovery while he's made in his bath. King Heron had given him given a goldsmith some gold and asked him to make a wreath from it. The goldsmith finished the wreath. Heron suspected the crafty goldsmith had pocketed some of the gold and replaced it with some cheaper metal. Yet the wreath weighed exactly the same as the original gold. How could the fraud be proved? Heron asked Archimedes, and even he found it a tricky problem. Then one day, while mulling over the problem in the bath, he suddenly noticed how the water level rose as it sunk deep into the bath. The story goes that Archimedes leapt straight out of the bath and ran naked through the streets to the king, shouting at the top of his voice, "Eureka, Eureka, I've got it, I've got it." Later, he showed the king the idea. First immersed the water a piece of gold that weighed the same as the wreath and pointed out the substance rise to the water level. He then immersed the wreath and showed that the water level was higher than before. Archimedes said this meant that the wreath must be a greater volume of the gold, even if it's the same weight. Therefore, it cannot be pure gold. The falling goldsmith was executed. This is a bit sad. But everyone gets killed. Whether the story is true or not. Oh, I love that. Here it is. This is what happened. Whether it's true or not, kids, and you know, the complete assholes have to just answer the question A in the exam. It's typical of Archimedes' amazingly neat and elegant science solutions to awkward questions. I don't know, this makes me vomit having to read this, and of how a small practical problem led him to a crucial theoretical insights, which is the sort of major problem, the issue, the idea that science is a general abstract way of thinking, devoid from the universe, a resource, science thinking resource, I think might be the story. It may be that this was the starting point of his groundbreaking work on hydrostatics and how things float. See the box on page 16. Mathematical insights. Archimedes also tried to approach the problems mathematically. He may not have been the first to realize that if weight is put on each end of the seesaw, the lighter weight must be further away than the heavier if the two weights balance. But Archimedes went further and showed the ratio of weights to one another goes down to the exact mathematical portion of the distance from the pivot to the seesaw, and proved it mathematically. In the same way, he had a brilliant insight that every object has a centre of gravity, a single point, the balance of which always things to hang, and again proved it mathematically. It is interesting, but the interesting thing is that he proved it mathematically with no equations. Equations had not been invented yet. So we can get a school kid to prove something by training them up with the tools. And it's like getting someone to basically getting kids to do mathematical logic. It's like giving them IKEA furniture. And look, you've built your furniture. It's like flat packed. Interestingly, besides looking at practical problems in a mathematical way, he looked at mathematical problems in a practical way. And this, if anything, was even more revolutionary. Though it took over 2,000 years to realise it, the work of Archimedes was proudest of his solution to geometrical problems. There's a special problem working out the volumes of areas of regular states, such as spheres and cones. Pretty amazing stuff. I really like that. Some of his mathematical achievements are purely abstract in the Greek tradition. He showed, for instance, the surface area of a sphere is 4 times the area of the greatest circle. In other words, 4 times the area of the circle, the same radius. Yeah, so a flat surface, a flat a circle is pi r squared, and a sphere is 4 pi r squared. It's sort of pretty amazing. You can sort of imagine that it's, you know, a circle's got one flat surface, then 2 pi r squared is the surface above, and then you can blow it up and you need twice the volume of it. Or if I get a circle and I pump it up such as a hemisphere, it doubles the surface area. So a bit of a complex thing to go. In other words, he also showed the volume of a sphere is 2/3 the volume of a cylinder in which it fits perfectly. Indeed, he was so proud of this discovery, he asked the diagram of the sphere inside a cylinder to be inscribed on his tomb, and it was. Well, that's what we're told. But it was when he introduced the practical ways of working, he achieved his greatest insights. The Greek tradition had disdained the practical. Following Plato, the Greeks believed pure mathematics was the key to perfect truth and lay behind the imperfect real world, which is Plato's theory of form. So it's interesting that Plato's theories of forms influenced Archimedes more than Aristotle's. Archimedes' genius was to see that although the limitations of this and realize just how much could be achieved through practical approximations, or, as the Greeks called them, mechanics. It is clear he knew how much he was working against the Greek tradition when he wrote to a colleague in Alexandria about the solution of the problem, quote, "This concerns geometrical theorem which has not been investigated before, but now has been investigated by me. I first discovered the theorem by means of mechanics and demonstrated it by means of geometry." So, yeah, the idea is that mechanics, it was like we used geometry to make a machine. They made a machine to point a direction of geometry. It's quite an interesting, beautiful way of thinking. This approach certainly bore fruit for Archimedes. For instance, he was able to work out the approximate area of a circle by first working out the area of the biggest hexagon that could fit inside it, and then the area of the smallest area that would fit around it. And with the idea in mind, the area of a circle must be pretty much halfway between. By going from hexagon and polygons with 96 sides, he, which is a beautiful thing, beautiful piece of work, could narrow the error considerably and found the figure pi is 22 on 7. That is still good enough for most mathematical calculations for today. In the same way, he worked out, which is interesting, there's also pi by 10 to the 7 seconds around the world. A year is pi by 10 to the 7 seconds, and the square root of 10 is roughly pi, or pi squared is roughly 10. Either way. In the same way, he worked out the approximate area contained by all kinds of different curves and areas, rectangles fitted into a curve. The smaller and more numerous the rectangles, the closer the figure he got. This is the basis of what thousands of years later became known as the integral calculus, which became the most powerful mathematical tool for science in the hands of scientists like Newton and successors. I think, you can say Newton did it, but again, Newton didn't have the benefit of Cartesian equations, and reading it is the most laborious thing possible. There's no papers for it. Death and legacy. And by the time the Roman fleets besieged Syracuse in 212 BC, Archimedes was an old man, perhaps 80. That upsets me. That really upsets me because I thought, well, if he's 80, they do have a birth date of him, don't they? Oh, well. Okay, that really upsets me. As Roman ships closed in on the city, the aging Archimedes was in the thick of things, coming up with all kinds of ingenious contraptions to keep the enemy at bay. But even a genius, Archimedes, could not keep the Romans at bay forever. The Roman commander Marsus had been so impressed with Archimedes' contraptions that he insisted his science could be treated as well as his troops finally entered the city. So it's sort of like reading the US forces sort of walking, going triumphantly into Basra, and they show you little bits like CNN reporting on it. Sadly, the Roman officer who came upon Archimedes had not got the message. Oh, I told them not to shoot, not friendly fire, and he got killed by a drone. According to one story, the soldier burst through the door and found him working on circles and making calculations in the sand tray. "Please do not disturb my calculations," he barked. The battle-weary soldier, with no mood for argument, had ordered Archimedes to come with him. Archimedes insisted on finishing his calculation first. So the soldier drew his sword and killed him. As if, Romans are normally resistant to kill people. Sadly, in spite of his fame, much of Archimedes' work was lost and was only gradually rediscovered or reconstructed with the word, I think this piece of archaeology. It's only worthwhile if I attach the name to Archimedes to it. Sort of like, a piece of footage is the original footage of a fantastic film director. It's sort of a pretty amazing thing. Some of the important works have been never found. Remarkably, one major work was rediscovered in 1906 when a Danish philologist, J.L. Heidelberg, found a medieval parchment discovered in Jerusalem Monastery was a pamphlet, that is, a scroll in which the original writing had been partially erased so it can be used for the new text. Here, beneath the Greek Orthodox scriptures, were hidden copies of various key works of Archimedes. Enough of Archimedes' works has kept alive the Arab mathematicians through the Dark Ages for it to finally be taken of advantage when the scientific revolution began in Europe in the 17th century. That's 17th to the 1600s around, so that's from the death of Queen Elizabeth I. Galileo acknowledges his debt to the remarkable Greek scientists by saying, quote, "Without Archimedes, I could have achieved nothing." While Newton, another fan, said, "If I've ever seen further, it's only by standing on the shoulders of giants." And for him, the greatest of all giants was Archimedes. Although they merely mean that he said, I think that's really a misquote if I've ever come across it. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.